The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
If you are passionate about food and how it supports well-being and health, learn more. The Institute for Optimum Nutrition has been training nutritional therapists for 35 years on its highly acclaimed and accredited diploma courses. Start your new career in nutritional therapy, one that will make a difference and help others achieve their health goals. Train with the home of nutritional therapy education. Find us online and give us a call or click on the IOM banner on the UK Health Radio homepage.
Recovery Today on UKHealthRadio.com. Join me and my guests on this voyage of recovery and discovery.
Hello, everyone. Hi, my name is Jim Smith, and welcome to Recovery Today. Now, today's programme is slightly different. My guest today is myself. It's Tom, my producer, who was the kind of focus of the show last week, is going to interview me. So into it we go, Tom.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Hi, everyone. As Jim's mentioned, it's Tom Davidson here at the helm interviewing Jim Smith today for Recovery Today. So where did it all start for you, Jim?
Like everything else, Tom, it started at the beginning. And the beginning for me was in Croydon. Croydon town. Well, I was born in 1948. I was actually born, I mean, all this is retrospective now with what I've come to know. I was born in 1948 in a mother and baby home in South Norwood. And I was with my natural mother for a few months. And then I was adopted into a family in West Croydon. I was the only child, you know. So that's where it all started for me. Yeah.
And so what were those early years like growing up, Jim? So you were adopted at a very early age.
Well, I've got fond memories, really, of my early years. My mum, my dad were great. They were really good. I mean, my dad was quite a character. He'd had a tough life, actually. He'd grown up with a mother who was alcoholic, who... when he started his first job, or after his first week, he got his wages, bought a pair of shoes for work, and he found out on the Monday that they were in the pawn shop. His mother had pawned them for money for booze. So he'd had a tough time. And he would have won a scholarship, like a lot of people in those days, working class guys and women, mainly men, that he would have won a scholarship to the grammar school, but she couldn't afford, you know, the uniform and all that. So he went into hairdressing. But he was a lovely man, my dad. And I remember he built this great fish pond in the garden, and he was very good with his hands, a very kind of practical man. He built me a little kind of train, and I remember that very well. I think I still got some photos of me in the train.
Brilliant.
We used to go out a lot for days at the weekend. He'd work all week, obviously, being a hairdresser. Good memories. School, I lived right next to the school, really. So, you know, it was very close to me in proximity. I didn't find it easy, the transition from home to school.
So were there no nurseries in those days? Was your introduction to school, as we say now, infant school level, so about 4 or 5 years
old?
Yeah,
about right. 4 years. Well, about four, I think, but it was straight into elementary and primary school. Yeah, there was no introduction via nurseries and that kind of thing, you know. And my mother, you know, and bless her really, she kind of doted on me. I think, you know, because I later found out that she'd lost a child and told she couldn't have her own children, you know, she couldn't conceive. And, you know, when I came along, she really she killed me with kindness, really, in many ways, you know. So it was hard to go to school. I found it quite difficult, yeah.
So those early school years, did you, what memories do you have of school then, you know, growing up in that area? And, you know, what was school like then? What was your life like then?
Yeah, I mean, generally it was, it's just as I said, it was, they were fond memories. Lots of playing in the streets in those days, you know, going out, you know, and playing with friends in the streets, around the rec, as we called it, the recreational park. You know, no health and safety really in those days, so we'd fall off all these rides and swings and cut ourselves, and you know, it, but somehow we became resilient and now had a lot of fun, really. Just good memories.
So how did you feel in those years? Did you, you know, you did you know you were adopted?
Well, I didn't consciously. I say that because although I didn't know, I kind of, I think unconsciously, I had an idea that there was something not quite right, because I used to look in the house, and I'd go in when my mum and dad weren't around, I'd go in their bedroom and look through drawers and boxes of letters and to kind of, and I think really I was looking for who I was, you know. I remember when I was about 5 years old playing with a little girl down the road, and we were pushing each other. She pushed me over, I pushed her over. And she said, "I hate you," she said. "Anyway, your mummy's not your real mummy." And that really cut me to the quick and had quite a profound effect on
me. Yeah, so maybe hit a subconscious. Yeah. You know, you felt that something wasn't right. And
definitely, yeah, Tom, yeah.
She'd hit the nail on the head without you really even knowing that was the case. So
that's right.
So growing up then, as you, you know, early teens, where were you then? So you kind of, you're in school and you're living your life and from a loving background. And, but you're an only child as well.
Well, yes, it's an only child. Yeah, in that.
So growing, kind of coming of age and, you know, where did music figure in your early years as well?
Yeah, music's always been a big part of my life. I loved listening to music on the radio in those days. You know, rock and roll. This was the early 50s I was growing up, born in 1948. So a friend of mine said, "When you tell this story, Jim, it's like a non-story." And he's right to an extent, but I still say it, tell it. Buddy Holly came to Croydon in 1958. I was 10 years old. And the night he was playing, my cousin came round the house to have a haircut before going to see Buddy in concert in Croydon. And I begged my cousin to take me with him to see him, see Buddy Holly. But he only had one ticket and he couldn't take me. So that's the kind of Buddy Holly story that is a non-story, but
so close, but yet so far.
So close, but so far away. But I used to listen to a lot of music. Used to listen to a lot of radio as well. But significantly, when I was about 14, 15 years old, I'd gone on, by the way, this was in the days of 11 plus, and I just kind of scraped through and went to a technical school. In South Norwood, strangely enough, again, South Norwood, where I was born. And it's quite significant in the sense that my cousin, the same cousin who came round on that Buddy Holly evening, emigrated to Canada, and he left me his old guitar. It was terrible, really. It had a terrible action. It was a Rosetti, and you could hardly fret it, but I could get a few sounds out of it, and I really loved kind of tinkering about with it. And then I got a slightly better one and more playable one, and I took to it like a duck to water, really.
Brilliant. So you were playing at a very early age.
And well,
were you self-taught? 15, 16. So you were listening to
artists
that you enjoyed, and then were you getting any musical... Were you being taught music, or were you self-taught, or...?
This guy, you know, lived in the neighbourhood, was a really fine guitarist, and he used to, him and his brother used to import all this stuff from America, and, you know, blues, folk, And he took me to my first folk club when I was 15 years old. It was in a pub called the Wheat Sheaf in Thornton Heath Pond. And I saw a guy called Wiz Jones, who incidentally is nearly 80 years old now, and he's still playing and gigging.
Brilliant.
And he's got a celebration in a couple of months with Ralph McTell's supporting him, and he's doing a kind of anniversary gig. But Wiz Jones played blues, he flat-picked and did kind of country songs, and yeah, this was quite a significant moment, really, going to this folk club. It was quite funny because we went upstairs at the pub, and there was the kind of remnants of the beatnik era. You know, this was kind of early 60s. And I said to my friend, "What about all these people on the floor?" He said, "Don't worry, just walk over them. They won't mind." And I thought, wow, that's amazing. And they didn't mind. Were beatniks. And Wiz Jones was he was a beatnik, really. He used to go down to Cornwall and Devon and bus down there. He bussed in Paris and Europe. He's quite a character.
Fantastic. Yeah. So very involved in music. And I love the fact that you talk about how friends or people in the neighbourhood were getting music imported from America, because you know, in the world we're in today, music's so accessible. Oh, we can listen to anything at the drop of a hat.
Yes.
But back then, I mean, even when I was growing up, it was more difficult to come by music because of the formats. But, you know, you were hearing stuff that maybe other people weren't necessarily hearing at a young age, and that was influencing you.
Well, that's it. And in fact, one of my choices of music today on this show is a Bob Dylan track. And I remember my friend Colin importing Bob Dylan's first album, and which came out in the early 60s, but it wasn't available in the UK, you know. I know when it arrived, it was amazing listening to this, you know.
So, Jim, maybe this is a good opportunity to hear your first track choice, which is Bob Dylan, "Baby, Can I Follow You Down?"
I first heard this from Rick Von Schmidt. He lives in Cambridge. Rick's a blues guitar player. I met him one day in the green pastures of Harvard University. Follow you down, baby, let me follow you down. Well, I'd do anything in this God Almighty world if you just let me follow you down. Can I come home with you? Baby, can I come home with you? Yes, I'd do anything in this God Almighty world if you just let me come home with you. Baby, let me follow you down. Baby, let me follow you down. Well, I'd do anything in this God Almighty world if you just let me follow you down.
So that was "Baby, Can I Follow You Down" by Bob Dylan from his first album.
Yeah.
Great track, Jim.
Yeah, it's a great track. And actually, The Animals recorded it. In fact, This was track two, I think, on one of the sides of Bob Dylan's albums. And the next track was House of the Rising Sun. And the Animals recorded Baby Can I Follow You Down. And then they recorded The House of the Rising Sun, which was a global hit. So they were very influenced by Dylan. But I love that track and the way he's finger picking this intro, but he's speaking over the music. You know, and he tells you when he met Rick Von Smith on the green pastures of Harvard University. I'll never forget that, listening to that in my bedroom, you know. Very powerful, yeah.
Brilliant. And so Bob Dylan, as an artist, I mean, he's been covered by lots of very well-known artists. I mean, one of my favourite Hendrix tracks, All Along the Watchtower, is a Bob Dylan record.
Yeah, you know? That's right.
So what was Bob Dylan, I mean, musically, he was interesting and new, but what other angle was he coming from as well with his music?
Well, I think as well as his musicianship and everything like that, he was saying things that I'd never heard before. He was, in his songs, he was talking about, singing about social injustice, with an anti-war material, you know, with God on Our Side, which is a great track. It's a very poignant song. So he was singing about social injustice, singing anti-war songs, really singing about things that mattered in the world, you know.
And using music as a medium to communicate.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, he was.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And so where were you with your using at this time, James?
Well,
kind of a teenager experiencing new music and playing and being creative. And what was going on with your early alcoholism and addiction? Well,
yeah, I took a drink. My first drink of alcohol was when I was 15. And my first drug was shortly after that. And it was self-medication. I love the feeling. I never liked the taste of any alcoholic drink at all. And everything I took, whether it was liquid or, you know, orally with tablets, I used cocaine, but not very often, just a few times. But everything I took was just to change how I felt. And, you know, this got in the way. Well, it became an obstacle to everything I did, really. Because my music, by this time I'd met someone in the music business. He was a session guitarist. His name was John Mark, and he was accompanying a woman called Marianne Faithfull. And he was right on the scene, if you like, you know, with Jimmy Page. He was one of just a handful of session musicians at that time, in the early 60s. And he mentored me, and he really tried to help me set up a couple of auditions. However, you know, there was one big problem. That was my addiction. Yeah.
And so that your drinking and drug use got in the way of opportunity then, Jim?
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally, yeah. Yeah, it really, you know, my drinking and my addiction just got in the way of everything, really. Just a couple of small regrets. I used to go and see an American guy up in the Cromwell Road, opposite the Natural History Museum. Guy called Mick, and he was a really lovely guy, and he worked for Donovan. Him and his partner did the artwork for Donovan album sleeves. But he grew up in New York, and he knew a lot of musicians as friends, and Jimi Hendrix and Bob Dylan were personal friends, and they both stayed at his flat at various times, and he'd invite me up. He said, come on, don't take a drink, just make your way here and you can meet Bob and Jimmy. Of course, I never got there, which I must say, you know, a small regret. So it would have been really interesting to meet those two giants.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, unfortunately, as we know, Jim, addiction in whatever form is so powerful that it comes before anything, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
When we're in the throes of our addiction and it using. Does.
Yeah.
So were you travelling at all at this time? So is this kind of mid-teens, late teens?
This is kind of Yeah, well, when I was 16, I went, John got me a job in the south of France as on a yacht, working on a yacht. But I never quite got there. I got hung up in Paris for 10 months. And I had lots of addresses that he'd given me. But I met a student there, and we used to go out in the evening. He'd drive, and this light 15 Citroen, and he'd drive me to various venues in Paris, and I'd get out with my guitar, play, busk in the streets, and get money. And, you know, it was a good time, and I'd pay him rent for one of his rooms. He lived off the Champs-Élysées. And so I had an adventure then. You know, I had a big adventure over there. I met Memphis Slim in one of these clubs, played a blues to him, and that was quite memorable. That's quite something. So I had a lot of it. But when I came back, you know, I was 17, and, yeah, it was kind of turning sour, really. I was drinking my way out of, you know, John's world, the professional musicians I knew up in London, and, you know, although some of them kind of I saw much later in recovery, but at that time they were just using and drinking, but keeping their lives together. And although I was much younger, I wasn't, you know, maintaining anything at all, really. You know, my addiction was leading the way. Yeah.
So, Jim, where did your using lead you then?
Yeah, well, that's it, really. Addiction does lead us, doesn't it? We don't lead it. It takes us where it wants to take us. And it was pretty awful, really. I was, you know, committing minor offences and falling down, getting arrested. Oh, you know, stealing from the people I loved, my parents and friends. Placed on probation, even went to prison for several weeks as non-payment of fine. It was all getting very chaotic. I was having fits. And in fact, on one hospitalisation, I had DTs. That happened twice, real DTs, and that was frightening. I thought I was really losing my sanity. It was one of the most horrific times of my life. However, to 1969, I went to a self-help group, a 12-step meeting, which really saved my life. You know, I'd gone there because I was drinking surgical spirit, diluting this stuff over many months. I told a doctor, a local GP, about this, and his best friend was a member of this group and had had a long period of recovery. And you know, when I was at this meeting, I got immense hope, and I knew that what they were talking about themselves applied to me 100%. Although they were a lot older than me and perhaps from a different generation, different culture, whatever, it didn't matter. I thought I belong here with these people. It was a great sea change that night. However, I didn't stop. My addiction went on for a few more years, being hospitalised many, many times.
So the seed was planted then from yeah, that meeting with that GP, and also yeah, by the sounds of things, you'd kind of had enough, really, hadn't you, by the sounds of things? You needed help.
I needed help, and it's, yeah.
But like we hear a lot, you know, we're pointed in the direction of help, and it still can take time for the addict to get sober or clean and continue a life of recovery, you know. So
that's right.
After that initial meeting that you went to, yeah, and feeling part of, you said you used for a few more years. Was there a moment that you thought this, you know, was there a moment of enlightenment, or was there a point at which you said, I really have had enough, and that's when your recovery started? Or,
well, Tom, there was eventually a profound moment of enlightenment. But after that first meeting, there was, I think, about 5.5-6 years where I was just hospitalised for many months. Then I'd be discharged, then I couldn't cope, I'd be taken back. I was sectioned 3 times under the Mental Health Act. This went on, then my mother died. And then fairly shortly afterwards, my father died, my dad died, and you know, it was pretty terrible. And then after he died, you know, all hell broke loose in a sense, and I just, you know, started drinking, and because I'd remained abstinent for the last few months of his life, just out of respect. But anyway, I started drinking and selling stuff I'd been left, like the car and the mobile home. It was just awful. It was just a terrible mess. And I woke up in Orpington General in a side room. I'd been in intensive care, so I still had lots of apparatus attached to me. And but the moments after that were quite profound. And, you know, for the first time in my life, I just wanted it all to stop. I just wanted to live. Mm. You know, I've got the will to live on that day, really.
Mm.
Yeah.
Amazing. I can relate to that too. Yeah. There was a moment for me, you know, and yeah. A similar route in that I went and spoke to a healthcare professional as a GP, and they pointed me in the direction of help. Mm. And it was still a bit of time of, you know, trying to use successfully, which I couldn't. But I remember then getting into treatment, and that arriving in that treatment centre was there was a moment on that day that I arrived where I was like, this is it. That's I don't have to live this life anymore.
No,
you know, there's an opportunity for change here. So
that's right. Well, I, like you, I went to a marvellous rehab called Pinnell House. It was the first treatment centre in the country. 1952 it started, Mallingham Park, Surrey. Founded by a man called Dr. Max Glatt, a pioneer in addiction. I don't think anybody's surpassed him, really. He was amazing. So I went to that treatment centre. I was good and ready. And then after the 3 months, I was funded to go to a halfway house for 15 months because I had nowhere to go. So that's how my recovery began, really. And that was in the day I had that enlightened moment was 27th of October 1976. So, you know, I went into treatment. Then I spent, you know, two Christmases, one in the treatment centre, and then I spent a Christmas at Trelawn, I think, the halfway house. And 1977, I left and went into a bedsit. You know, for the first time, I was living on my own as a man of 27, you know, emotionally going on 5 or 6 years, years development age, you know.
So you've got some help, and you've started your life again.
I did. Yeah,
know? I love the fact that you talk about, you know, you're a man of 27 with the emotional age of a 5-year-old.
Yeah,
and I can relate to that. And I think my experience was my emotional development was stunted when I started using.
Exactly. Yes.
So, yeah, your new life begins in recovery. You're clean. You've done treatment. Where did you go from there?
Well, you know, that meeting I went to in 1969 had such a profound effect on me. I started to go to meetings similar to that in the area, in the neighbourhood, and also I'd get trains up to London. There were quite a lot of these recovery meetings up there. And I never forget, in 1977, I had a meeting, they call it a where to find list of meetings, and there were 77 meetings in the whole of London in 1977. And I think now there's about 850, so things have changed. But I was meeting people up there, you know, I was getting befriended by people that had no angle at all. They just wanted to help me, which I'd never experienced before. It was quite a revelation, really.
So you were beginning to rebuild your life, and you're on your recovery journey.
Yeah.
Did you start working? Did you start studying? What?
Not at first, I was on Valium for many years, and I was totally addicted to them. And I came off cold turkey in this mental hospital before going into treatment, which was very highly dangerous. It was very irresponsible, but that was the thinking of the time. So it left me with a lot of anxiety, probably the anxiety that was always in me, and then the anxiety for coming and being dependent on Valium for 13 years. So it was tough, but not all the time, you know, and there'd been people that had walked that path before regarding benzos and their recovery. So I got great help from people, you know. I worked after several months and I got an office job in Croydon. And that was quite significant because I made a friend in the job and he wasn't in recovery. You know, this was like my first friend, if you like, outside the fellowship of recovery.
Mm.
And I still know him. We still keep in contact. So that was quite something, really.
Yeah. Right. Building your life up.
Yeah.
So, Jim, should we have a... Do you fancy another track? Should we look at your second choice?
I do fancy another track, yeah.
Okay, and your second choice is a Bert Jansch track called Angie.
Yeah, well, I chose this because, you know, I've always loved the singer-songwriter genre, and I saw Bert Jansch and David Graham and John Martin and all these people when I was in my teens. I play similar to that. James Taylor's a great favourite of mine as well. I mean, when we're asked to choose three tracks, Tom, it's nigh impossible, isn't it, really? You know?
Yeah.
You know, but this particular instrumental called Angie, David Graham wrote it. Bert Jansch, I prefer his version. It's quite a dynamic version. But it was so significant. It was like the footprint of what was going on in the 60s in the folk blues clubs. So... here's Bert Jansch playing Angie.
That was Angie by Bert Jansch.
Yes, it was. And it's funny, at one point in folk clubs, if you couldn't play that, you weren't a serious musician, you know. that's quite funny. But Bert Jansch was a great musician. He really, his music hallmarked a whole new genre in guitar, singer-songwriting. I actually played with him once. I was on the same bill as him when I played. I was about 18. And I think Bert is gone now. He passed away a few years ago, but his music will always be with us anyway, yeah. Yeah, so that was Angie.
Great choice, Jim. Brilliant. So, professionally, because you've spent a lot of time in your work life working with people in addiction, people with mental health issues, young people. Maybe, do you want to share a little bit about your career, as it were?
Yeah, I'd love to. I suppose, I don't know, maybe it happens in different ways for different people, but when I used to listen to Bob Dylan and, you know, songs that contain social injustice, as well as wanted to play my music, you know, maybe be a musician or a semi-pro musician, I thought, you know, I had some kind of concern for my fellow person. So, you know, after a few jobs, I learned to drive in recovery and did some driving jobs. I wanted to work with, it's funny, you know, I asked an old mentor, a friend of mine, Len B. He was a great guy, Len. He'd been in recovery for over 30 years and he had this great accent. He used to, Cunning, Baffling and Powerful. And I used to impersonate him. And I know Rory Bremner, but I could do his voice. And I was at this meeting one evening impersonating him. And somebody put their hand on my shoulder and it was him, it was Len. He'd caught me impersonating him. And he said, yes, very good. Don't let me catch you doing it again. But I went to Len at this point. I said, look, Len, I'm pretty frustrated. I'm driving. It's all right. I'm doing these driving jobs, but I want to do something different. He said, what do you want to do then, son? I said, well, I want to work with people. And he said, in what capacity? I said, well, you know, in a helping way. And he said, well, do some voluntary work and get yourself on a counselling course. That's all he said. And I did those two things. And it actually paid off because the voluntary work I did, the guy running Mind in Croydon had worked for Barnardo's with Adolescents in Care. And he said, I think you'd fit in there, Jim. And then I saw you know, as a lot of things has happened in my life in recovery, it's almost as though it was laid out if I chose to take these opportunities. Mm. I actually saw a position, a vacancy at this residential environment hostel in South Norwood again, this connection with South Norwood. And as a residential social worker working with adolescents in care. And I got the job and I was there for 13 years. And it was challenging, as they say now, difficult, you know, but, you know, I really did learn a lot from these young people. They're incredibly resilient, incredibly kind of creative. And some of their lives had been absolutely disastrous, but they'd come through it, you know. When I'd been there several years, I had the opportunity to train to get my qualification as a social worker, which I took. And because I left school with no qualifications, so you know, I really got to enjoy studying. And like a lot of us, you know, with that addictive part of us, I really got addicted to learning. I loved it, you know, all these references after pieces of work and that. No, I really enjoyed it, which led on really in my professional career to be a care manager for London authorities, you know, assessing and directing people to treatment for their addiction. So that's been quite wonderful, really.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so family, did you?
Yeah, I got married to my ex-partner, Lindsay, and we were married for 20 years. Then we went in separate directions and we have three children. In fact, three daughters, Melanie, Lydia and Harriet. In fact, as I speak now, Harriet is waiting, really, to give birth to her first child, which is quite wonderful,
fantastic.
Really.
Yeah,
she had contractions this morning. She went to the hospital with her husband, but they sent her home, so she's got to wait a bit. Either today or tomorrow, she'll have her a little boy, actually, because, of course, it's all changed today. Like,
yeah, you can know the sex of your baby before it's born. Yeah,
it is a little boy, so she'll be,
So talking of family, Jim, and, you talked about you were adopted and... you didn't know, and then that was disclosed, as a teenager. And did you ever discover any of your birth family?
Well, that's the, as they used to say, the $5,000 question. I mean, throughout my recovery, I've wanted to know my origins, my roots. Because obviously, as I shared earlier, my mum and dad, who brought me up, and they were wonderful, and they were my mum and dad, they were fantastic. They died before I actually got into recovery. So over the years, after every, several years or 10 years, I'd have another kind of stab, so to speak, of trying to find my origins. I got my birth certificate first, and I saw that my birth mother, my natural mother, was called Mary Josephine Higgins. And she'd called me Kevin Higgins. And apparently that was her favourite name for a boy. A couple of years ago, I thought I'd try one last attempt because there was very limited information regarding my adoption. And I got my records from the social worker in Bromley here, and there was nothing new emerged at all. And then my eldest daughter, Melanie, suggested that I might like to do a DNA test. So I went along with that and I said, yeah, okay, I'll do a DNA test. And the result of that DNA test, Tom, as you know, I discovered one of my many siblings. I discovered Kathy in New Jersey. And yes, at this stage of my life, I've discovered and found my birth family, and I'm the eldest of 10. I'm the eldest of 10, and Kathy lives in New Jersey, Mary lives in Germany, and the rest of my siblings, my brothers and sisters, live in Ireland. My mother died in 2015, so we just kind of missed each other, so to speak. But as you can imagine, that's been... well, it's been quite a journey.
Absolutely.
The last few years of my life have, in many ways.
Yeah, quite wonderful, really, that reconnection with family and connection with Ireland. I'd like to play out the last track and then we'll have a little bit of a chat. Talking of the Irish connection, your last choice here is No Frontiers by Mary Black.
Yes, it is. That it's a lovely, lovely song. In fact, I play it. I do a version of it. But it was written by a wonderful songwriter from Ireland called Jimmy McCarthy. He's written all the kind of great Irish songs of late, Ride On and this one and lots of others. Anyway, this is Mary Black's version. And the reason I chose this, because I actually love her version. And several years ago, I was in a studio, and you were there as well, weren't you?
I was there.
Yeah, and we were, we were involved in making an album for Pam, a singer-songwriter called Pam. And Pam was going out with a guy called Martin Black at the time.
Fiddle player, wasn't he?
Mandolin, who lived in Dublin. And I know, went to stay there one weekend with him. And on the Saturday evening, we went to this delightful little theatre in Dublin. He said, come on, we're going to see my sister. And, it was his sister, Mary Black. And we went to see her. And she was just fantastic. And she had a wonderful team of musicians accompanying her, which some of them are on this version we're going to play now, called No Frontiers.
Brilliant. Here it is. No Frontiers by Mary Black.
And just like water, baby, baby, born to float. And if life is a wild wind that blows way on high, and your heart is Amelia dying to fly, heaven knows no frontier. Seen heaven in your eyes. And if life is a bar room in which we must wait, round the man with his fingers on the ivory gates, where we sing until dawn of our fears and stack all the dead men in self-addressed crates. In your eyes faint as the singing of a lark, but somehow this black night feels warmer for the spark, warmer for the spark to hold.
Okay, that was No Frontiers by Mary Black. What a great choice, Jim.
Yeah, she's a great artist and it's a great song. In a way, there are no frontiers, you know. It's very relevant for me at the moment.
So where are you now, Jim? Where are you today, as one says?
Yeah, well, today, a few months ago, I was 70 years old. And I've been 42 years of those 70 years in on the road.
It's the same number of years recovery. I've been alive.
Yeah, yet. And you're 42, you know, aren't you? 42, so there's kind of synchronicity there. And the last 2.5-3 years, as you know, it's been majestic in the sense I found my family. I've also had a couple of major health issues. I had prostate cancer. I finished the treatment for that, and I've had one result of the test, blood test, and that was very good. So got another one in April and then two more. So that's, and then I had a tumor, benign tumor on my brain, and I've had I've had all the treatment for that, but it's going to take a couple of years to shrink and to get a full recovery. So I'm in a way, Tom, I'm on another recovery now.
Yeah.
But it's good. I've got a lot ahead of me. This radio show, we've done several now, you and I, and that's been one of the things. I've got some other things lined up for the next couple of years, projects. And, well, what can I say? You know, I'll carry on, you know, walking the happy road to destiny one day at a time.
Absolutely.
And maybe if I could, I'd like to close with, in 2011, I won a Winston Churchill Award and I went to America to look into music and recovery. And there's an amazing guy in upstate New York in a rehab called Veritas Villas, House of Truth. Him and his wife started the rehab in 1959. Jim sadly passed away a couple of years ago, but he was about 60, I think he was 63 years sober when he died, and he was in his 80s. And he was an amazing man, and I only kind of knew him a few days. But when I was coming to leave, I stayed there for a couple of days, and he said, "Jim, it's been a pleasure having you." He said, "Always remember this." And I looked at this man because he lived a long life, and he was 63 years sober. And I thought, well, I listened to this guy. He could have a lot to say, you know. And he said, "Look, everything's going to be okay in the end." I said, yeah. And he said, "If it ain't okay, it ain't the end." Thank you for listening, everyone. And join me next time.
Here's the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a fellowship for anyone who has a drinking problem. The number is 0800 917 7650. That's 0800 917 7650. The number of Narcotics Anonymous, this is a fellowship for anyone who has a drug problem. That's from 10 a.m. till midnight. The number is 0300 999 1212. 0300 999 1212. And finally, Al-Anon, which is a fellowship to support family and friends of the alcoholic. It's from 10 a.m. till 10 p.m. The number is 0207 403 0888. That's 0207 403 0888.